surprise, especially me. In the middle of February, I had started cooperating with the staff completely. I turned on the charm. By the time I left, everyone loved me. I had gone on a campaign to get out of there. I even organized a blood drive for the Red Cross on my ward. I took out the blood of half the patients in the ward because they trusted me more than the nurses. After that, everyone trusted me, patients and doctors alike. I bided my time. I smiled at everyone. Then I secretly began to prepare for what I was going to do when I got out. As we listened to Jordan, we began to see the world as he saw it back then, after a long season of psychotic drugs and shock treatment. It was during his stay in solitary, he said, that the attraction to monastic withdrawal began its pull on him. Back on the wards, he discovered the power of words to calm the terror of the meek and the distraught. He began to speak like a priest during this period and hid from everyone the terrible hatred that moved like a virus in his heart. The priest in him was born, but the warrior still seethed beneath. The only voices he heard in those long months in prison were those of his father and Capus. Their voices came to him nightly, taunting him. When he left the hospital, his plan was set. He wrote a postcard to his parents, telling them that he was hitchhiking to California, where he wanted to take up surfing seriously again. Then he caught a ride with a policeman who was camping on the beach at St. Michael's Island with his girlfriend, and who let him off at the gate on Pollock Island. There, he introduced himself to the corporal on duty as General Elliot's son, and caught a ride with the deputy provost marshal to the PX, and from there he walked to the general's quarters. The house was huge and mainly unoccupied, and he spent the night in the unused servants' quarters. Noiselessly, he hid among the man-sized azaleas and watched his parents eat dinner with no inkling that he was observing their every bite. For the next 2 days, he said, he prepared his long answer to his father's humiliation of him on the courthouse steps. In his father's workshop, he made a small incendiary bomb with 2 flashlight batteries to power the small but effective detonator. He configured the architecture of the bomb carefully, borrowing freely from the supply of gunpowder his old man used to make musket balls for the Civil War rifle used by one of their ancestors who rode with Wade Hampton. He wanted it lightweight and volatile, but safe enough for him to carry around by hand until he set the timer. He drew elaborate maps and worked out his plan in his mind again and again, making the necessary corrections until the proper time for action presented itself. When his mother went out during the day and the maid was cleaning the upstairs, he moved quietly in the back door of the house and stole food from the pantry that looked forlorn and forgotten. When the maid had gone, he would sit at his mother's vanity and take in all her smells, the way he did as a boy. He even spent one night in his room because he wanted to capture again the feeling of being there. He could have forgiven his father every crime but one. He could not forgive him for stealing his entire childhood. When his parents went away for a weekend at Highlands in the North Carolina mountains, he made his final arrangements. He wrote a letter to them, telling them every single thing he planned to do and why. He told them what he believed deeply and everything he had come to feel about the world. He stated his opposition to the Vietnam War and admitted it had only grown stronger during his enforced imprisonment in Colombia. The only weakness that he acknowledged in his anti-war stance was his unwillingness to fight violence with violence of his own. To his mother, he left his undying love and gratitude. To his father, he left his corpse and his loathing and thanks for absolutely nothing. The letter, the rambling, embarrassingly rhetorical, half-cocked, egomaniacal relic of the 60s, he left in his mother's jewelry box. On the Saturday night he chose to act, he walked a half-mile to the marina, carrying his surfboard over his head. The night before, he had placed the bomb beneath the front seat of the boat he had reserved for the weekend, by phone, in the name of his father's adjutant's son. He had checked out the engine by test riding it the night before. He packed it with extra tanks of gas, junk food, and Coca-Cola, took a bottle of wild turkey from his father's liquor cabinet, then loaded bags of blood he had stolen from the donors at the state hospital. He packed the 4 pints of blood in newspaper and cotton gauze, then placed them in a small carry-on bag that he put in the fish locker. The blood was all type O, his own. He described to us the care with which he dressed in his father's uniform, given himself the rank of major, and placing all emblems of rank and all insignia in their proper places. He spit-shined his father's shoes. His hair was already cut in Marine Corps fashion, thanks to the strict rules of his ward. Studying himself in his father's full-length mirror, he got a sudden glimpse of the life his father had wanted for him. He was a fine-looking Marine, but admitted that on this night he was a dangerous, angry man who was thinking unclearly, his rage undercutting all undertones of reason. In the General's staff car, he drove erect in the rainy night. Several soldiers saluted when they saw the stars on the front fender, and no one, he remarked wryly, returned a salute as sharply as Jordan Elliott, bred to the Corps. He drove the 5 miles to the Waterford Air Station, received the snappy salute of a PFC, then proceeded toward the airstrip and the hangars where the great warplanes were at rest. There were lights on in the guardhouses and officers on duty. But checking every squadron, looking for movement or signs of life, he saw that everything was hunkered down. He said it took him a little while to decide whether he wanted to blow up an A-4 or a Phantom jet. He loved the clean lines and beauty of both. Once, he explained, he had wanted to be a Marine aviator more than anything in the world. He wanted to be the flyboy who could come swiftly from the sky to rescue his father's beleaguered, pinned-down regiment. That was a lifetime ago, but thinking about the past made him nostalgic, detoured him from concentrating on the mission at hand. But it bothered him, he explained to us, to blow up a plane he had once dreamt of flying, as though it would destroy that small part of his childhood that he could still return to without tears. As he drove his father's car past the Bumblebee Squadron, the Shamrock Squadron, the shapes became grotesque and vaporous. And then he saw it, a DC-3 parked at the end of the runway, a forlorn remnant of a past era of flight. Perfect for the point he wanted to make to his father. He pulled the car off the road behind some large shrubbery. He had packed the bomb carefully and now rewrapped the package with waterproof cloth before he moved out toward the plane. Only the lights of the runway lit his way, and he felt invisible, he said, even to himself. Swiftly and efficiently, he taped the package to the bottom of the DC-3's fuselage near the gas tank. He set the timer on the clock to go off at 4 o'clock that morning. He did not remember returning to Pollock Island, nor did he remember parking his father's car in the garage and returning the extra key to its hiding place beneath the paint can. In his parents' room again, he hung up his father's uniform in a closet. He went to a photograph album and took from it a favorite photograph of himself and his mother. Before he replaced his father's shoes, he cleaned and spit-shined them again. Going to his father's bathroom, he stole a fresh packet of Gillette blades from his medicine cabinet. With a tube of his mother's lipstick, he wrote the word Jordan on his father's shaving kit. Jordan turned to face the general. I wanted you to know I had used the house as the base of operations. Going to his mother's vanity, he read again his suicide note, which he thought sounded rather shrill. He hoped he would have the courage to kill himself when the time came, but if not, he had an alternate plan of action. Checking his watch, he went to his room and changed into a bathing suit and his sweat clothes. Walking through the house for a last time, he took a final inventory of the things that had accompanied him through childhood. I was still running when I reached the marina and untied the boat from its moorings and let it drift out with the tide. I did not start the motor until I was almost to the main channel in the Sound. I was past the 3-mile limit when the DC-3 exploded. When he told us this, no one moved a single muscle in the Dock Street Theater. It looked as though all of us had forgotten how to breathe. I knew all too well what else was going on that night. Just before midnight, Corporal Willett Egglesby met with the daughter of Colonel Harold Pruitt at a secret rendezvous in the breezeway of a vacant house located 3 houses away from the one where Bonnie Pruitt had escaped through a bedroom window. Their love affair had not gone over well with the rank-conscious Ellen Pruitt, who hounded her malleable husband to the point where he forbade his 17-year-old daughter to date her ardent corporal. Unbearable tension had become commonplace in the Pruitt household, until the corporal discovered the DC-3 on the runway near her house. Corporal Egglesby and the young Pruitt girl were making love when the bomb detonated, and the two youngsters were buried side by side in the National Cemetery located down the road in Waterford. Yet in the extraordinary mayhem caused by the plane's explosion, and in the reaction of the Marine Fire Brigade, as well as of Waterford's fire station, much evidence was lost. There were so many firemen tracking through the scene of the fire, which no one suspected to be a crime. The bodies of Bonnie Pruitt and Corporal Eglesby were not found until late the next afternoon by naval experts flown in to examine the wreckage. When these same experts went to the house of Colonel Pruitt, the distraught and guilt-ridden Ellen Pruitt produced three suicide notes that Bonnie had written to her parents, declaring that she would kill herself if her parents insisted on keeping her apart from Willard Eglesby. Corporal Eglesby himself was the son of a highway construction engineer from West Virginia who was an expert with explosives. After a thorough investigation, the naval experts agreed that the two lovers had made a suicide pact together and that the corporal had assembled a more-than-functional bomb to carry out their dark pledge to each other. In the experts' report, they lamented in the stiff-jointed language of career bureaucrats that the DC-3 gas tanks were full when the bomb went off. It was also noted that the couple was making love when the explosion occurred, and that intercourse was not often linked to such obvious despair. Celestine Elliott took up the narrative from there, slipping elegantly into the witness chair and speaking in the direction of Jordan, Ladere, and myself. She said that General Elliott had caught a hop back to the air station when he heard of the catastrophe. She drove directly from Highlands to their quarters on Pollock Island. By the time her husband arrived home after long hours of organizing the scene and talking to news agencies, she had rid the house of any sign of Jordan's presence. She had scrubbed out his name, which he had written in her lipstick on her husband's shaving kit. She had followed her son's footsteps from the maid's quarters to her husband's workshop to the letter he had written and carefully hidden in her jewel box. She had read Jordan's letter confessing to the crime of blowing up the plane, in which he explained that he had done this to show his father that he had inherited the general's fine, martial spirit, a spirit that understood the nature of military strategy, bold offensive, and the element of surprise. Jordan wanted the destroyed plane to end his father's career as a Marine officer. He wanted to bring disgrace and ruin to his father's house. This act was his reply to his father's humiliation of him on the courthouse steps. His father's spit would be answered with fire and his own blood. In sentences that she had found almost unbearable to read, Celestine said, holding back her tears, Jordan described how he'd reserved the boat under another Marine's son's name and stolen the packet of Gillette razors. He wrote that he would head the boat out to sea at night. He would cut his wrists and throat, and when he felt weak, would lower himself over the sides of the boat after tying an anchor to his waist. The last sentences were incoherent, she said, and far from characteristic of Jordan. She burnt her son's last letter because she did not think her husband could survive it. She burnt it and washed the ashes down her kitchen drain. She fixed herself a drink and waited for her husband to come home. When the general arrived, a new wife awaited him, one far more broken and tamed than the one he had left on a golf course at Highlands. Celestine began to drift into a twilight region where she seemed to be either sleepwalking or drinking far too much. Her husband thought the drinking was due to the death of Jordan. It had started after his boat was found drifting in the Atlantic, with traces of his Type O blood soaking the seat cushions and staining the woodwork. The shrimper who found the boat said it looked as if someone had slaughtered a buck in the boat's gunwale. It was then that the Elliots consulted with the chaplain and planned the small, private memorial service for Jordan. After the service, General Elliott confronted Shyla, Mike, and me outside the base church.
"I want you to know I think that his friends are responsible for my son's death," General Elliott said, as Celestine tried to pull him away.
Shyla flashed with anger.
"Funny, none of us raised him or hit him. We just loved Jordan. We didn't spit on him or put him into an insane asylum."
"He was the best friend we ever had," I said, pulling Shyla out of harm's way. "We adored him."
"We know you did, Jack,"
Celestine said, and only when she spoke did we realize that Jordan's mother was drunk. For 3 years, she stayed drunk and mourned her son and loathed her husband, yet hated herself for still loving the general. By her husband's side, Celestin did not feel a thing. Bourbon was a brown distraction, and she drank until her husband was forced to retire out of embarrassment for her. On the day he retired at Pollock Island, 3 years after Jordan's memorial service, she passed out on the reviewing stand and awoke in a detoxification center in Florida. Twice General Elliot had learned the hard way that enemies within a city's walls are 10 times more dangerous than armies in the field and on the move. Many in the Corps had thought that the general would one day receive a presidential appointment as commandant, but his troubles within his own family pointed to a lack of judgment and discipline on the home front. Mike Hess stood up from his seat near my father and said, "So what is this day about? All this happened over 15 years ago. It's terrible about the young girl and her Marine. No one denies that. But the important thing is to go on, right or wrong. Those of us here all suffered because this war touched us in ways that we still don't know. Shala never was quite the same after protesting that war. Jordan we lost. He's been dead to most of us until now. We watched our generation turn against one another, hate one another, not speak to one another. And for what? Is this day about forgiveness?" General Elliot stood and said,
"No, it's about justice."
"Justice for whom, General?" The abbot of Mepkin Abbey stood on the stage, his cowl thrust in his face in shadow. "For you or for God? Are you seeking military justice or divine justice?"
"I'm seeking both, Father," the general answered, "and I believe you and your entire order have stood in the way of justice of any kind."
"We know your son as a good priest and servant of God," Father Jude said quietly.
"He blew up 2 innocent people, the general said. "That's all that even God needs to know about my son."
Judge McCall tapped his gavel and checked his watch.
"Let's figure out what we're doing. Let's bring this thing to a close."
"How did you get out of the country, son?" the general asked. "They found your boat out at sea."
"My surfboard," Jordan said. "It took me over 2 days to get back to land. I stayed a week on the Isle of Orion, at the McCall's fish camp. I got my bearings. I fished and crabbed at night. When I felt rested and strong enough, I took Jack's John boat and made my way to his house in the middle of the night." I rose and said, "I can take the story from here." Grief that spring lay immobile in me. After Jordan's memorial service, I went to bed and stayed in my room, locking my door, and tried to figure out the exact moment when everything had gone wrong in my life. Soon after the service, Shala left for an anti-war demonstration outside the UN building in New York, but I declined to join her. I had promised myself never again to lose all control over the circumstances that history might fling in my path. I planned to live a life of caution and restraint. I would grow my own herbs in a window box, raise a vegetable garden each year to remind myself that I was part of a grand cycle, improve my vocabulary by reading those authors happy to dance with the language, and choose my friends for their lack of oddness or flamboyance. No longer did I wish to suffer because of the furious energies of my best friend's passions for the high wire. Jordan had died because of his willfulness and his inability to either make peace with or avoid the orbit of his father. Shala had rejected her parents' own passivity and thrown herself headlong into every new idea she encountered on the road that gave meaning to her life. Like some lost rabbi, her life was a constant search for a Torah yet to be written. Mike's ambition burned with a bright flame, and already he was working in the mailroom of the William Morris Agency in Manhattan, and had pitched his first film project to an agent he met in the steam room of the New York Athletic Club. Each night he attended movies and off-Broadway plays that he wrote to me about, always appending his own notes and critiques, specifying how he would have improved the production had he been in charge. Mike did not suffer from the Southerner's burden of always looking back. I discovered that I had a shut-in's gift for paralysis. And then one night I woke up with a rough hand covering my mouth. I tried to scream, but I heard Jordan whispering for me to keep quiet. In the darkness, I went over the contours of Jordan's face to make sure it was him. Too surprised to speak, I put on a pair of Bermudas, old Docksiders, and a T-shirt, and followed Jordan outside and down past the great oak, through the insect-shrill garden, and out to the floating dock, where we took off our shoes and let our feet dangle in the flooding tide.
"How's Jesus?" I asked. "I heard you'd gone to see him."
"The boy's fine. Asked about you," Jordan said. Then he darkened.
"I'm not right. Something's not right about me, Jack."
"You'll get no argument from me," I agreed. "Your blood was all over that boat."
"My type, but it belonged to other people," Jordan said. "I passed my time in the crazy house planning this. What did my father say about the plane?"
"What plane?" I asked.
"The one I blew up," said Jordan.
"You didn't do that, Jordan," I said, praying that I was right.
Jordan said in an eerie, disembodied voice, "I could field strip an M1 blindfolded by the time I was 8 years old. Want to know how to make a Molotov cocktail, a pipe bomb? Want me to show you how to set a punji stick dipped in human feces along a trail? I've walked half the sewer system in Waterford, so I'd know how to escape if the communists ever took over."
"Something far worse than that happened, Jordan," I said.
"I went too far with the plane, Jack," Jordan said. "I knew you'd hate that."
"You ever heard of Willett Eglesby or Bonnie Pruitt?" I asked.
"Nah, who are they?"
"They were in the plane when it went up," I explained. "Folks think they blew themselves up, a lover's pact."
I never understood why Jordan's scream of anguish did not wake every single sleeper in Waterford that night. The sound of horror erupted, unbidden and undefiled, from Jordan's throat. As he wept freely, I held him and tried to come up with a plan to hide him. Before daybreak, I managed to lead him back through the garden, up the tree, and into my bedroom. I pulled a chair under the trap door in my closet and led Jordan into the attic to sleep on a pile of old mattresses. The breakdown that General Elliot had manufactured now began to take hold of Jordan Elliot in earnest. He suffered grievously in the unbearable heat of that attic as the only other person in the world who knew he was alive plotted his escape in the bedroom below. When Shala arrived back in the Low Country the next day, I was waiting for her at the train station in Yamassee. She had developed a gift for functioning in the atmosphere of a war room and prided herself on keeping a cool head when chaos was the order of the day, and I needed her for Jordan. I brought her to the attic, where the heat was oppressive, and the three of us sweated as we tried to devise a way to remove Jordan from harm's way. We discussed going to our parents for help, but it was not the best time in the history of the Republic for us to trust the counsel of our elders. We had all grown up too fast in the past few years, and had experienced enough sedition among our own ranks to be able to trust anyone but ourselves. It was Shala who came up with the cover story, and I who devised the route of escape. I got my car ready for a long journey, bought a used canoe from a Methodist girls' camp near Orangeburg, and a tent from a hunting outfitter in Charleston. Shala was in charge of food, which she packed in a picnic basket, placing the overflow in an ice chest. There were sausages and cheeses, bags of apples and oranges, dried fruits and cans of sardines, tuna fish, and enough bottles of wine to lend an air of festivity to every meal, no matter how quickly we had to consume it during our time on the run. Shala went to her doctor, complained of sleeplessness and depression, and walked away with enough Valium and sleeping pills to put a small herd of bison asleep. Jordan slept for the first time under her careful dispensing of the medicine. I went for a blood test that next day and wrote a long letter to my parents in the periodical section of the town library. The letter was difficult to master because I was unaccustomed to the shy language of love. I had not started out to write a love letter, but that was what it turned into, even though I knew it would cause my parents enormous pain. I let Shala read my letter as I was reading hers to George and Ruth Fox. Her letter was lovely. Shala could express her love of her parents with a simplicity I could only envy. I leaned over and kissed her as she concentrated on what I had written. She looked up, and I think it was at that moment that we gave our lives to each other. The three of us left Waterford at 2 a.m. We pushed my car far down the oak-lined street before starting the engine. Jordan lay beneath piles of blankets in the back seat. Both letters lay on the breakfast tables in the houses where Shala and I had grown up. The letters explained that we had gone off to get married and would spend our honeymoon at Lake Lure in the North Carolina mountains.
In fact, we were moving toward the outskirts of Chicago less than 24 hours later, heading north. We took turns driving and stopped only for gas and to use the restrooms, and we talked endlessly about the life we had shared together. We talked about everything except those dense, prodigious events that had precipitated our headlong journey into the unknown. At one point, when I was studying a map, Jordan said, "It's hard to believe South Carolina and Minnesota are in the same country." "It's all so weird," Shiloh said. "They had to talk these people and all the people in South Carolina into going halfway across the world to shoot at Vietnamese peasants. That's some trick."
"If you never mention the Vietnam War again," I said, "I promise you'll never be included in any wife-beating statistics."
"You ever touch me," Shiloh said, "you'll be reading about yourself when they interview eunuchs."
"Be happy. That's an order. You two owe me that much," Jordan said. At the Gunderson Motel in Grand Marais, we spent the night under assumed names and went to the Bear Track Outfitters for a detailed map of an unpopulated borderland called the Boundary Waters. A guide worked out a route for us that would take us through pristine wilderness. Early the next morning, we set off in a mist so soft it felt related to dandelion seed. We took down the canoe at a lake marked on the map, and as we moved our paddles through the waters, it was like entering into some cavern hollowed out of pure turquoise. At night, we camped on the banks of lakes and bathed naked in water still cold from the runoff of snow. We chilled our bottles of wine in the rocks that lined the edges of the water. We slept together in the same tent at night as we followed a string of lakes strung like a rosary through the thick, humming forests, where black bears hustled their cubs away from the shoreline when our canoe appeared, and moose observed us as calmly as philatelists when we moved past their quiet foraging in deep water. On this voyage, our friendship, our unspoken love for one another, formed a mansion without pillars or supports. Drifting, we knew we were heading for a time when Jordan would disappear from our lives as precipitously as he had entered them on a skateboard, wild hair flying, so many years before. Shiloh could feel the silence of glades healing Jordan of his most immediate agony. Wolves started to call to each other across the vast wilderness, and we once heard a pack in full flight during a hunt. When we talked about God, we found it was easy to believe in him while moving through the medallion-like waters of these sun-swelled lakes. On pebbled beaches where we camped, Jordan would pull agates and fire opals from stream beds and present them to us as wedding gifts. For 10 days we drifted, and only when we came to a small lakeside town and saw a Canadian Mountie walking down a dock did we realize our journey was over. For 3 days we had been in Canadian waters without knowing it. In Canada, Jordan could make his way among an entire people tolerant of war resistors. When we ate dinner on our last night together, Shiloh and I toasted Jordan and drank to his future. We were sure we would never see him again, and he told us that he would only put us in danger if he tried to communicate with us in any way. "What you did for me goes beyond friendship," Jordan said, "because I know that you're both horrified by what I did. I'll try to make up for my actions. I'll try to find meaning in all this, I promise."
"We love you, Jordan," Shiloh said. "That's meaning enough for anybody."
When we woke the next day, Jordan had slipped out into the Canadian countryside to begin his life on the run. Shiloh and I started back where the memory of Jordan was imprinted on every lake we crossed. We made love for the first time in Canada and found we liked it. It took us twice as long to retrace our steps back to Grand Marais. We told ourselves we had raised the art of a honeymoon to new plateaus. One night we made love listening to a wolf pack gathering for the hunt. We both agreed we had started our married life off right. So we were married the next day by a justice of the peace in Grand Marais, Minnesota. It took us 3 weeks of camping before we finally made it back to South Carolina and the lives we were meant to lead. The silence was passionate yet abstract in the theater when I stopped speaking and returned to my seat. We all needed to compose ourselves in the late Charleston afternoon. Like figures in a painting, we looked as though we had lost ourselves in some barely glimpsed, stolen landscape where no one spoke our native tongue.
Jordan had awakened a part of all of us that had long ago fallen prey to easy associations of misremembrance. The theater felt like a confessional underground. In the airlessness that followed my account, I swallowed the dust of time itself. I tried to consider the part I had played in this excruciating drama of my college years, and realized I did not recognize the description of the boy I once was. Somewhere in this story, I found myself missing in action in a tale of my own life. I waited for a summing up, a gathering of all the disparate and contradicting parts, a voice from the past to grant benediction for a life I did not even realize I was leading. In those heady days, I had let instinct rule my every move and thought nothing through completely. The young man who had spirited Jordan through the wolf-haunted country of the Boundary Waters was dead and unmourned. I had lost the fiery, irreconcilable boy I once was on a Charleston bridge, yet realized that was the boy that everyone on this stage remembered as me. It was the same boy I feared had sent Shyla to her death, signed the marching orders that directed her to the railing overlooking Charleston and the home we shared together. Looking at Ladere, I saw her studying me, and I knew that Ladere had bided her time throughout this year and had made the error of falling in love with me. She wore this love in her eyes, all over her face, and made no effort to hide it. I wanted to warn her, to tell her that my love was all fury and sharp edges. I made a sport of killing the women I loved, and I did it with a guile and a softness that had all the markings of a true vocation. But everywhere I looked on that stage, I found love peeling off from a dark squadron, making strafing runs against me. I had failed to live fully because I had not come to terms with the alliances and fates of this imbalanced gathering of souls. Our pain bound us in a terrible love knot. I wanted to speak, but so did everyone else. We waited, wordless, and the cameras rolled, unnoted, all around us. Something was keeping us from talking to one another. A presence had come onto the stage, unbidden and invisible. As long as it lay there undetected, there would be no armistice among us. I had not felt the presence of this ghost for so long, it took me a while to recognize its demoralizing ascension. Then I saw it, and could recognize it as an old friend that had trailed us to this stage. "Hello, Vietnam," I said to myself. "Long time no see." Yet it inked its shape in the tissues of the silence that held us in its tense, concentric folds. As a country, Vietnam was not important, but as a wound, it was unbearable. We could not run far enough away from it. It followed us on stumps and crutches, prided itself on being omnipresent and inescapable. Though I had hated that war with my body and soul, I realized sitting there that Vietnam was still my war. I had blamed it for the great unraveling it had brought to America, the self-doubt, the breakdown of courtesy, the death of form, and the falling apart of all the old truths and the integrity of both law and institutions. Everything came up for grabs, nothing survived the cut. The facile and the cheap became celebrated, and the speech of idiots took on a benighted, kingly quality. Solidity was a concept found only in physics textbooks. Indifference took center stage, and it was hard to believe anything. God pulled back. I had searched the whole world for something to believe in, and I had come up empty-handed every time. "Hello, Vietnam," I said again to myself. "Time for us to make friends," as I waited for one of us to find our voice. Finally, someone spoke, and I was surprised to hear Capers Middleton's voice. "What was all this really about? I've heard everything, and I still don't understand it. I need help with this, I truly do." "That's how life goes," General Elliot said. "There are no guarantees."
"How convenient for you to say that," his wife, Celestine, said. "Avoid responsibility. Spread the blame like you've always done."
"What I'd like to know," Capers began.
"You're too hard on yourself," Betsy said, taking her husband's arm.
"No, let me say this," Capers said, and he looked as troubled as I've ever seen a man look. "I had no idea how this would turn out. I'd have done it all differently. I had no idea it could lead to all this. It hurt people I thought the world of.
It won't let go of me. It's always there.
I'm a lot easier on myself, Radical Bob Merrill said with an easy grin. Unlike the rest of us, Jordan's recitation had no emotional impact on him at all. I did what I thought was right back then. Hindsight's groovy, but a total waste of time. Mike Hess, the producer again, snapped his finger and said, Bye-bye, Radical Bob. Go back to the hotel. Enjoy dinner and fly back into your life. You're dismissed.
Bob Merrill rose up and walked off stage right and out of our lives forever. No one watched him go or even said goodbye.
Okay, Mike said, facing the rest of us. We need an ending to all this. Gotta find an ending. Let's help each other out now.
It got away from me, Dad, Jordan said to his father. Nothing was clear to me.
The times were folded wrong, odd. You couldn't hold them up and look at them. Things happened too fast,
Ladare said.
You weren't even alive then, Ladare, Mike said. That was one spaceship you didn't ride.
I was watching, Ladare said. I inherited Capers, pulled him out of the wreckage. I think he suffered from all we've just listened to. I didn't think Capers could ever forgive me for loving him after what he did to his friends.
I don't think you know the real Capers, Betsy said, rushing to her husband's defense.
I'm guilty of a little insider trading there, Ladare said. I've got more than a passing acquaintance of your boy there.
Well, that wasn't the real Capers, Betsy insisted. Not the one I know.
No, honey, Capers said. They knew that was the real me. I'm asking them to accept that part of me. It was there all the time, and all of them knew it. What I didn't know is that it had the power to hurt my friends. I ruined Jordan Elliott's life. Look what I did to his parents.
Betsy let the words settle, then said, You've always been your own harshest critic.
Shut up, Betsy, Mike Hess said. Pretty please, but shut up.
Can there be forgiveness? Capers asked. That's what I have to know.
You? Asking forgiveness of them? General Elliott said in disbelief. You're the only one on this stage who conducted yourself with honor in this whole affair.
What would you know about honor? Celestine asked her husband. Tell us all you know about the subject, darling. Tell it to the wife and son you betrayed.
Dad was true to his code, Mom, Jordan said. He betrayed no one.
Harsh code, I said.
I didn't understand it either, Jordan admitted, until I met a couple of Jesuits in Rome.
Father Jude and the abbot laughed, but the joke was too ecclesiastical for the rest of us.
Jordan, Ladare said, did you become a priest because it was the best place to hide from the past?
No, he said. It was the best place to hide from the present, and from myself. But I grew into my vocation, Ladare. I was born to be a priest, but I had to kill two innocent people to find that out.
Why didn't you just say an extra rosary, son? The general asked sarcastically. It would have saved the two lives and the Marine Corps a plane.
I wish it had happened that way, Dad, said Jordan, his hands folded across his lap.
What a shame you lacked character, General Elliott said to his son.
It wasn't character I lacked, Jordan said. It was moderation.
Leave my son alone, Celestine said.
He's my son, too, the general said.
I said, Then act like it. Look at him when he speaks, General.
I can't help who I am, General Elliott said directly to me.
Nor can I, Dad, Jordan said quietly.
Celestine rose to her feet and approached her husband fiercely.
Don't you see it, Rembert? It's so obvious now. No one could have acted in a different manner than they did. Fate's a maidservant of character. Hired help and nothing else. You haven't changed one degree since I met you. Look at you. Pure of spirit, holier than thou. Watch your rigidity. I know what you're after today. I don't have to ask you. You don't have thoughts, only patterns. You'd charge an enemy's foxhole to save the lives of all of us here. But you'd charge it harder if you knew our son was hiding there. You want our boy in prison. You want him to rot in jail.
Jordan said, I'm a monk, Mom. Cells hold no fear for me. It's another place to pray in.
You were stolen out of my life, Jordan, she said. I can never forgive him for doing that. And I never can forgive myself for letting it happen. I'm divorcing your father out of pure shame and exhaustion.
"You're wrong to do that, Celestin," the general said. "It's not that you loved Jordan more than I did. It's that you appeared to, that's all. The appearances of things formed you. I admit that."
"Go on, General," said Mike Cass, and it came out as an order, not a request. The general appeared surprised. Then he went on.
"I submit that I loved Jordan as much as my wife did, but within the restraints and limits of a man of my time. I was good at leading men into battle. Few men possess that gift. I could always connect with fighting men. A better father couldn't have been as good a soldier."
There was a rap on the gavel, and I heard my father speak.
"You're no longer a Marine, Rembert. That's all over. What are you going to do about Jordan now?"
"I'm going to hold him accountable," the general answered.
"I've seen something today that surprised me," my father said, and suddenly I saw him look at me. "Jordan holds you in much higher regard than Jack holds me. Anyone can see that, yet it seems to mean nothing to you."
"Jordan was raised to know right from wrong," the general began, "but when his country called, he was absent."
"You mean the Vietnam thing?" Capers asked.
"Yeah, the Vietnam thing," the general answered. "You can't help the generation you were born in. I'm grateful I wasn't born in yours."
"Yeah, you came from great folks," I said, nearly exploding. "Thanks for presenting my generation with that fabulous little war. We'll die grateful that we tore into each other because you guys were stupid."
"It was too much war for you, Jack," General Elliott said.
I replied, "It was too little war for me, General. That's what you don't get."
"I was expecting more from you, Rembert," my father said to the general.
"You were expecting more of me?" the general asked, his voice stony.
"Jordan came here because he wanted to tell you his story," the judge said. "All the rest of us are superfluous."
"You fought the Germans in Europe, Judge. You were a decorated infantryman. What do you think about Jack and the others, and how they responded when our nation needed them?"
"I wouldn't have done it their way," my father admitted.
"Indeed," the general said.
"But let's be truthful. We're holding them up to standards that no longer apply," the judge said. "My son Jack stood up for what he believed in. That's how he was raised."
I nodded my appreciation to my father, and he returned it in kind. The general watched the acknowledgments pass between us.
"Let's be brutally honest," the general said. "He was raised by the town drunk, Judge. Standards, you say? I doubt if you were sober long enough to know if Jack was in the house."
"Stand at attention when you talk to my old man," I said to the general. "Ever talk to him like that again, and I'll mop the fucking floor with your cheekbones."
The gavel hammered again, and my father said,
"You're out of order, Jack. The general has made an excellent point."
"I'm very sorry for that, Johnson Haygood," General Elliott said.
"The heat of battle," my father said generously. "No harm done. Apologize to the general, Jack."
"Sorry, Rembert," I said, calling him by his first name for the first time in my life. "Got carried away."
"I like the thought of you wiping the floor with Rembert," Celestin said, and Mike laughed out loud, cutting some of the tension that had built up.
"I've missed you, Jordan," Capers said, rising out of his seat and approaching the priest cautiously from the opposite side of the stage.
"I can't get over that y'all think I betrayed my best friends. I can't think of myself like that. It goes against the grain. Shiloh died without ever speaking to me again. I wrote her a letter once, telling her I loved her, loved all of you, that none of us was responsible for what happened at Carolina. Shiloh sent the letter back unopened. Jack still can't look at me without hating my guts."
Capers looked over at me and said,
"Don't deny it, Jack."
"You hear anyone denying it?" I said.
"Shiloh thought you loved her, Capers," Ladera said. "A couple of us made that mistake."
"I was bad news for you, Ladera," Capers said. "Every time I looked at you, it reminded me of how much I'd lost."
"Small potatoes, dear. All I gave up was my 20s and my belief in matrimony," Ladera said. "Otherwise, I came out without a scratch."
"I'm sorry. Please forgive me," Capers said.
"That's enough, Capers," Betsy said. "Don't crawl. It doesn't become you, darling."
"Whoa," Mike said. "Pure ice, Betsy. An Eskimo girl couldn't have said it better or served it up chillier."
"I'm sorry, Ladera," Capers said. "When I left you, I had started to notice that my life had gone wrong."
Please save it, Capers, I said. Hypocrisy makes me weepy. The gavel again. Dad.
Jack, if you can't bring yourself to make peace with one of your best friends, then what hope does Jordan have with his father? How do we resolve this?
The film's running down. We need a wrap, people, Mike said. I looked at my father and understood what was required of me this night, so I got up and faced Capers, who was still standing.
I'm sorry, Jack. So sorry, he said to me. I wish I could do it all again. I'd make everything right.
When you're governor, I'm sending you all my parking tickets, I said. We shook hands, and when we both felt that we meant it, we embraced. The general stood up, and both Capers and I took our seats. He approached Jordan, who watched him come close without emotion.
You said this was a mock trial, the general said to Mike. I would like to cast my vote on the guilt or innocence of my son.
Good, Mike said, but I'm the producer and the director. I'm casting mine first, General. But hell, you understand the chain of command better than anyone. Not guilty.
Not guilty, Ladaire said, followed by Celestin saying the same thing.
Not guilty, the abbot and Father Jude said.
Not guilty, said Betsy and Capers.
Not guilty, said my father, the judge.
Now it's my vote, the general said, and I thought I heard his voice crack.
Celestin said to her son, who was meeting his father's stare,
It's not in him, Jordan. Love lies too deep for him. He can't get to it.
I can get there for him, Mom, Jordan said. It's easy for me.
I'm sorry, son,
the general said, but it was a father who was speaking now, not the general.
Jordan covered his father's mouth with his hand, with great gentleness.
No need for a vote, Dad. I know what it is, what it has to be. I came here to make it right with you. I've got to walk off this stage with a father in my life. I've proven that I can't live without one.
I can't help who I am, son, the general said when Jordan's hand dropped.
Nor I who I am, Jordan said.
Tell me you were wrong.
I was very wrong, Dad, the priest said. My hatred of you got in the way. I should have followed the path you set for me. America's a good enough country to die for, even when America's wrong. At least for a boy like me, raised the way you and Mom raised me.
That's far enough, Jordan, I said. It was a lousy war. Don't make him rub your nose in it any more.
What can I do, Dad? Jordan said, waiting for his father's judgment.
Turn yourself in, the general said. If you do this, I'll back you all the way. I'll fight for you.
Jordan bowed before his father, assenting to his will. The two Trappists rose and walked toward him, both gaunt, prayer-weathered men. Jordan knelt and received both their blessings.
The abbot then said, Jordan had me call General Petros at Pollock Island early this morning. I told him, General, that you'd be delivering your son to the Provost Marshal tomorrow at noon. General Petros would like you to come by his office first. He says he knew Jordan as a child.
There was a muffled sob as Celestin Elliott left her seat and ran toward the darkness at the rear of the stage. Jordan followed her, and we could hear him comforting his mother while the camera crew began to break up the set as the rest of us stood up in the middle of our actual lives. I watched my father walk over in his robes to comfort the general, who looked defeated and bereft after doing the only thing he could do. That evening, we ate dinner at Betsy and Capers Middleton's beach house on Sullivan's Island. I set up shop on the deck, looking out to the ocean, and grilled onions and eggplant, hamburgers and steaks and shrimp, until everyone was full and happy, and Mike and Jordan had to run out for some more beer. The Trappists had made their way back to Mepkin Abbey, and my father had driven the general back to Waterford. Celestin chose not to attend the party, but the rest of us felt great relief in the gathering at the Middleton household. Ladaire's children, Sarah and young Capers, were glad to see their parents under the same roof, talking casually, and Betsy proved a good hostess as we gathered around the dining room table, regaling each other with stories from the past. It was still strange for me to see Jordan out in public without looking over his shoulder or checking to see if someone had followed me to a secret rendezvous. A strange sense of freedom had come over him. He could not get enough of us. He drank us in, he fed on our spirits to the point of satiety.
we gave ourselves to him and let him have this night completely. After midnight, everyone had gone to bed somewhere in the sprawling house, but Jordan, Capers, Mike, and me. We found ourselves walking along the beach of Sullivan's Island as a ship passed out of the harbor, Asia-bound. The harbor pilot's boat met the ship when it reached the open sea, and we walked in silence as we saw the smaller boat return toward the city. "What now?" Mike asked. "I don't think I've ever been happier."
"What about Hollywood?" Capers said. "You have the pick of the starlets. You live like a king. That sounds better than eating burgers on a South Carolina beach with a bunch of high school assholes."
"Not to me," Mike said.
"Me neither," Jordan agreed.
"What about you?" Mike asked me.
"I hate to ruin the evening here," I said, "but I still think Capers is something of a scumbag."
"Oh, that," Mike said. "You'll get over it."
"Time passing," Jordan said, his eyes casting upward toward the stars. "It's the big surprise in life. It might be the only one. It feels like we've been on this beach forever, like we never lost each other."
"That reminds me," Capers said, snapping his fingers and running suddenly back toward his house. When he returned, he was carrying a surfboard over his head, and we cheered when we saw it. We stripped down to our underwear and plunged into the warm-blooded, air-cooled Atlantic. The waves were calm and half-hearted as we swam out to deep water.
"You call these waves?" Jordan said. "You call this an ocean?"
"The Jordan summer," Mike said, remembering.
"Never forgot it," I said.
"Remember my long hair?" the clean-cut monk said, laughing.
"Waterford's first hippie," Capers said. "My God, you were the first omen of the 60s. We should have tarred and feathered you and sent you back to where you belonged."
"Have sons, have sons," Mike cried happily.
"Where are the porpoises?" I asked. "We need porpoises, Mike."
"Give me special effects," Mike called out. "Call Warner Brothers."
"It comes back to this, then," said Capers.
"Life doubles back. It takes you by surprise," Jordan said.
"Like a good movie," Mike said.
"Where are you going to send me, Capers?" Jordan asked. "Where is it you think I belonged?"
We were floating in the Atlantic, holding onto the surfboard, with another summer ending and the warm wind soft against the surface and the taste of salt in our mouths. We drifted in the deep currents on a moonless night, and because we were low country boys, we were not afraid. Then Capers summed it up by reaching out and rumpling Jordan's hair, saying, "Here, you belong here with us, always."
Chapter 39, the last chapter. Every son will have his time in a room like this, I thought, as I joined my brothers in our watch over our mother's bed. The smell of chemotherapy was familiar, the metallic scent leaving its trace on the membranes of my tongue. Its business was to slaughter the white blood cells that had multiplied in Lucy's bloodstream, those white cells that moved with the thrift of herds, crowding the red cells to the point of extinction. In my mind's eye, I saw my mother's blood turning into a deadly snow, and when I looked at her, I saw for the first time terror in her pretty blue eyes. Every cell in her body was lit up with the unnameable fear.
"If you really loved Mama Jack," Dupree said, "you'd be out in your workshop finding a cure for cancer."
"That's what I hate about my brothers," John Harden said, walking to Lucy's side. "You heard that, Mama. We should all be trying to make you feel like $1 million, and stupid Dupree starts in with his jokes."
"Tell us how we go about making Mom feel like $1 million, Dallas said. "We seem to lack your genius for bedside manners."
"Go ahead, mock me, Dallas," John Harden said. "I realize I'm an easy target. I know you laugh behind my back, make fun of me, write about me in the latrine when you're taking a piss. I see those things you write about me. I recognize your ugly, repulsive handwriting."
Dallas shook his head and answered, "I've never written a word on a bathroom wall in my life."
"You don't even have the guts to admit it," John Harden said. "You and your kind are so despicable."
"I agree," T said. "Dallas and his kind are beneath contempt. What can you say about a man who won't own up to his own graffiti?"
"You write worse things about me than Dallas does," John Harden said to T. "But I've got you boys back good. I told Mom all about it. I told her everything. Mom knows, assholes. Mom's going to take care of business as soon as she's on her feet. Right, Mom?"
"That's right, John Harden," Lucy said weakly.
"You're dreaming, John Harden," T said, puzzled. "What did I write about you?"
"You wrote, 'Call Jay for the best blowjob in town,'" he said. "Then you wrote down my telephone number."
"You don't have a phone," Dallas said. "You live in a tree, same as a sparrow."
"I'm too sharp for you guys," John Harden said. "I'm always thinking way ahead of you guys."
"Quit picking on John Harden," Lucy said. "I read about Jordan's arrest. It was in the morning paper, honey."
"He should have stayed put," I said.
"The past is the hardest thing to run from," Lucy said. "I think Jordan got tired of running from a person he never really was."
"Look, Mom still loves Jack the most," John Harden observed. "It's not fair to prefer him just because of the stupid birth order."
"I was a child myself when Jack was born, John Harden," said Lucy, touching my face with her left hand. "I never had a baby doll to play with as a girl, so I pretended that Jack was a doll baby some stranger had left under a Christmas tree. I had no right to be raising up a child, being so young myself, but Jack couldn't know that. When I breastfed him for the first time, I didn't know the first thing about what I was doing. But Jack seemed to go along with everything I did. He made it easy for me. Jack and I grew up together. He was the best friend I ever had, and I knew he'd never leave me."
"I guess living in Italy was Jack's way of staying close," Dallas said.
"I wouldn't go to Italy if the Pope himself invited me to eat a ragu dinner with him," John Harden said. "Italians are the scariest people in the world. They're always taking blood oaths and selling drugs to black people and killing each other with shotguns. The men comb their hair with pig fat, and the women all have big tits and say the rosary constantly and eat food that ends with vowels. The mafia's been there so long, it surprises me there's a single Italian left alive."
"I got an idea," T said. "John Harden just proved what Hollywood has done to the image of Italians. Why doesn't the mafia quit killing police informers and concentrate on murdering Hollywood directors and producers?"
"Mama's getting tired," Dupree said. "Why don't we come back into her room later?"
"She's just tired of your sorry ass, Dupree," John Harden said. "But who isn't?"
Dupree shook his head and whispered to no one in particular,
"I can't believe I'm taking abuse from a psychotic."
"You hear that, Mom?" John Harden said, pointing an accusatory finger at Dupree. "That should get you at least a month's restriction and no allowance at all. Ha! That'll teach you to make fun of a helpless schizophrenic. All my problems stem from a toxic gene pool that tadpoles couldn't grow in, and a flock of shitbird brothers who've got no empathy for the disadvantaged among them. You assholes all picked on me when I was a little kid. Guess you hate me spilling the beans in front of Mom, huh, losers?"
"John Harden," I said, "did you notice that this is a hospital, that Mom's a bit under the weather?"
"Mr. Goddamn Big, Mr. I live in Europe and fuck anyone who lives in America. Mr. Chef Boyardee, don't faggots have more fun wearing aprons? Mr. Bullshit on Rice, trying to tell the little fellow what to do. It's always open season on the mentally ill, Mom. You heard it from me first, and now you're getting a live demonstration from your worthless sons."
"You're my sweetest boy, John Harden," Lucy said, taking him by the hands and drawing him toward her. "They don't understand my baby boy, do they?"
"They don't know a thing," John Harden said, his voice breaking. "They represent the normal world, and that's so scary, Mom. It's always frightened me."
"I'll make them be nice to you, honey," Lucy said, winking at the rest of us, holding John Harden close.
"We're the only kids in America punished for not being schizophrenics," Dallas said. "The dark one is jealous," T said.
"Green grows the dark one," Dupree agreed.
"Let's clear out of here," I said. "Mom needs to rest."
"One of us will be here at all times, Mama," Dupree said. "We're working out the shifts right now."
"They're leaving me out, Mom," John Harden said. "Me, the one who loves you the most. I don't get to sit with you in your time of greatest need."
"The nurses are scared to death of John Harden, Mama," Dallas said. "Everybody in town remembers the standoff at the bridge."
"I was hearing voices then," John Harden explained. "That wasn't the real me."
"It sure looked like the real you, bro," T said. "Sounded like you, too, when you forced all your poor brothers to leap naked into the river."
"I'm a victim of a dysfunctional family," John Harden said. "I'm not responsible for the actions I commit when the voices are in control."
"So if you barbecue poor Mom one night," Dupree said, "carve her up like a Christmas hog, and serve her up at the homeless shelter in Savannah,
we can't get pissed at you.
I have a mental illness, John Harden said proudly. It's documented.
Jesus Christ, I said. Family life's too exhausting for any American to bear.
Put John Harden on the night shift, T suggested. The boy has problems sleeping.
Midnight to 7, Dupree said to John Harden. Think you can handle that, John Harden? Or do you want one of us to stay with you for company?
You guys aren't company, John Harden said. You're just birthmarks I've got to put up with.
This won't be pretty 24 hours from now, Lucy said weakly. This stuff may kill the cancer cells, but it'll come pretty close to killing me, too.
John Harden studied the ominous plastic bag, filled with the foul-smelling liquid now being released into Lucy's bloodstream.
This shit don't work. It makes the doctors rich, the drug companies rich, and it'll kill our poor, wonderful mother. Vitamin C is the only thing that'll cure leukemia. I read it in Parade magazine.
Thank God we've got Mr. Wizard on our side, Dallas said. We gathered around Lucy's bed, and the five of us kissed her until she begged us to leave. T began to cry and said,
I love you with my body and soul, Mom, even though all of us recognize you did all you could to totally fuck my life up.
In the laughter that followed, Lucy sent us away before T took up the first watch. We had begun our vigil, and we timed our lives from that moment on around the cycles of her chemotherapy. I looked at my boisterous, free-spirited brothers and knew not one of us had done the hard work needed to face the next 30 or 40 years without Lucy. In our own ways, each of us had come to terms with his life's impassivity and cruelty. But now we faced head-on the prospect of arising one morning to a sunrise not only impersonal, but one that was Lucy-less as well. Outside in the waiting room, within its haze of tired cigarette smoke, we lingered for a final roundup of fears and thoughts. We all had seen the fear in Lucy's eyes.
I'm the only one here who thinks Mama's going to be alive 10 years from now, John Harden said. The rest of you boys have given up, haven't you?
After a few minutes of forced banter and reassurance, T said, I've got the first shift. Relieve me at midnight, John Harden. The rest of you country boys get some sleep.
Did you know that leukemia is the only cancer directly affected by the human emotions? John Harden asked us, his voice faintly disapproving. I'm the only optimist in this dark bunch. Mom needs us to be sunny, not surly.
If I go nuts and beat John Harden's brains out with a tire tool, how long would I spend in the big house?
Dupree asked Dallas. First offender, you'd be iced for 4 years max with time off for good behavior.
Can you do this? I asked John Harden, my arm across his shoulder. We can't afford any screw-ups. You've got to earn our trust.
Why? No one's ever trusted me before with anything, John Harden said. That's why I've got such a bone to pick with the whole universe. At midnight, while Waterford slept and the tide was moving out of the marshes and estuaries, John Harden relieved T. Half asleep himself, T gave John Harden a quick hug, then shuffled down the long, shiny linoleum floor, forgetting to tie his shoelaces. When a nurse came in at 12:30 to hook up a full bag of chemotherapy, she reported that John Harden was tense but friendly as she checked Lucy's temperature and took her blood pressure. When Dupree arrived at the hospital at 7 the next morning, he discovered that John Harden and Lucy were missing. At a side entrance to the hospital, Dupree found the wheelchair that John Harden had used to transport Lucy out of harm's way. He had left a note beneath her pillow that read, I refuse to let them kill my poor mother with their poisons. This will also prove to my mother that I've always loved her a lot more than my asshole brothers. Some may call me a madman, but my mother will know at last that I put her numero uno over all the mothers of the world. When we heard the news, we gathered at the judges to discuss strategies and apportion blame. Dallas scowled at Dupree and seemed more prickly than usual, while T opened a beer and threw his cup of freshly brewed coffee down the sink. In a time of stress, alcohol is the drug of choice, and caffeine is what you turn to when you've got to sober up, T said.
Once again, I'm the laughing stock of this town because of my damn family, Dallas said. You guys don't get it. People seek legal advice from pillars of the community. I look like the fire hydrant where the neighborhood chihuahuas mark their territory. I shouldn't have listened to you guys.
Mom insisted that we include John Harden, T said.
It was a slight error of calculation. Next time Mom's dying, we'll do it a bit differently.
Her doctor went apeshit, Dupree reported. He screamed at me for a half hour. Dr. Pitts wasn't overjoyed either.
Dallas said, She's got enough chemotherapy in her to make her sick as hell, but not do her a single bit of good.
He took Mom's car, I said. When he calmed down, Dr. Pitts told me all the food's missing from Mom's pantry. No liquor in sight. Blankets, sheets, and towels gone from the linen closet. I checked the treehouse when Dupree called this morning, and they're not there.
Dupree said,
He doesn't have a credit card or much money to speak of. Everything was still in Mom's purse. There's no place for him to go. The highway patrol's been alerted, and they should spot Mom's car soon enough and bring her back.
John Harden's got a few screws loose, T said, but he's smart as hell. The boy's got a plan, that I'll guarantee you.
You know why we're in this mess, Dallas said. Easy. Because our parents raised us up to be liberals in the South. They taught us to trust in our fellow man and to believe in his basic goodness. No one else in the world would let a psycho like John Harden watch over their dying mother except us. If we'd been raised conservative, like every other decent white Southerner, we'd never have let this nutbag near our mother.
I would be a conservative if I'd never met any, I said. They're selfish, mean-spirited, egocentric, reactionary, and boring.
Yeah, Dallas nodded. That's exactly what I aspire to.
Guilt, T said. I see Haiti, I feel guilty. Somalia, total guilt. El Salvador, bone-chilling guilt. Guatemala, guilt on the half-shell. The teeming streets of India, guilt.
Losing Mom, Dupree said.
Guilt, the four of us cried out as one.
We should have seen it coming, bros, said T.
Dallas countered by saying, How are you supposed to tell what a madman's going to do?
He's not a madman, Dupree said. He's our brother, and we've got to find him before Mom dies. We can't let her die out there with him. John Harden couldn't handle that.
I'll search the back roads, I said.
I know he still hangs out at yesterday's in Columbia, Dupree said. T and I'll talk to them. Why don't you go to Charleston and see if he's been spotted up there, Dallas?
Yoo-hoo, boys. Real job here. Real clients who need me to be in the office, secretary to pay, overhead. This ring any bells for you folks? Dallas asked.
Mom's Cadillac is rose red, I said. John Harden looked like a pimp on holiday rolling down a South Carolina back road.
Bet you miss Italy, don't you, bro? T asked.
Keo, I said.
I wish I'd been born Italian, Dallas said. Then I couldn't speak a word of English. I'd be completely in the dark. In this family, it's the only safe place to be.
We'll call my house at 6 tonight, I suggested. We can use Dallas's office as headquarters during the day. Where's Dad?
Drunk, Dupree said.
Gee whiz, I'm shocked, Dallas said. My papa overindulgent. It's so unlike him.
He drinks when there's pressure, Dupree explained.
The only other time he drinks is when there's no pressure, I said.
Though much can be held against the smaller states like South Carolina, they provide a sense of intimacy and balance to their citizens. In less than 24 hours, the whole state was on the lookout for a 1985 red Cadillac Seville, driven by a mental patient carrying a terribly weakened woman who had completed only 2/5 of her latest chemotherapy treatments. While T was checking hotel and motel reservations around the state, and Dallas called all the sheriffs in the most rural counties, I sat in the newsroom of the News and Courier in Charleston, making calls to editors, trying to get front-page space describing Lucy's disappearance. When Dupree returned to Columbia, he began searching out friends of John Harden's in the scruffy speakeasies located on the fringe of the university. Alcohol was the first hermitage John Harden sought when his mind grew disfigured and gauzy. In bars, he found non-judgmental friends who listened to him patiently as he listed the forces arrayed against him. In those mirrored rooms, there was comfort in the vacancy of strangers adrift in the same fool's paradise John Harden retreated to, when panic-stricken or broken by the free-fallen suffering that was his birthright. Dupree knew about John Harden's night circuit, and had often answered calls from bartenders when his brother had drunk too much to walk home. Dupree was always moved that John Harden had discovered a community of mislaid, churlish men and women who had also found life unbearable at times. When they heard about John Harden's disappearance with his mother, they opened up to Dupree and gave him the telephone numbers and names of other friends. On the third day, Dupree found the one friend who could tell him where John Harden had gone and how to find him. Vernon Pellerin was wandering among a lineup of drugged depressives, bumming cigarettes, 200 feet from Dupree's office on the grounds of the state hospital. Vernon was lightheaded with his own drugs, and he cheerfully told Dupree that he had given John Harden the keys to his family's fishing lodge on the Edisto River. He thought it was about 2 weeks ago at Muldoon's Bar near the Capitol that he gave him the keys. The lodge belonged to Vernon and his brother, Casey, now that his father had died, but Casey lived in Spokane, Washington. John Harden had revealed that he needed to find the most private, secluded spot in America because he wanted time to compose an essay that would change the course of contemporary society. Vernon was anxious to further a brave advance in American letters. The cabin was clean, simply furnished, and comfortable. However, it could only be reached by boat. The following morning, we put two bateaux into the Edisto River, just downstream from Orangeburg. T and I were in one, Dupree and Dallas in the other. We needed to get Lucy back to the hospital, but we had to make sure that we did not hurt our most fragile brother in the process, or get hurt by him. When John Harden turned to violence, he could terrorize an entire town, a fact that Waterford knew well and had experienced many times. We let the current take us down the swift, rain-swollen Edisto. Oaks on the two shores leaned out over the water, touched branches, and exchanged birds and serpents, passing them almost hand to hand from one to the other. Water snakes eyed our two boats as we passed beneath the low-hanging trees. Dallas counted seven snakes wrapped around branches of one water oak we passed under. "I hate snakes," Dallas said in a subdued voice. "What kind are they?" "Cottonmouth moccasins," T said. "They're deadly poisonous. They bite you and you've got 30 seconds to make your peace with Jesus."
"They're water snakes," Dupree said. "They're all right."
"I don't like going under a tree and noticing 50 living creatures sizing me up for a meal," Dallas said.
"The snakes are fine," Dupree said. "John Harden's our problem."
"Maybe we'll catch him in a good mood," I said. "Tell him we've got great tickets for the next Rolling Stones concert."
"I doubt it," Dupree said. "He's late for his shot. He's probably been drinking and he'll be agitated because he thinks the doctors are trying to kill Mom. We've got to be flexible when we see him. If we can talk him into letting us have Mom back, that's great. But we've got to get her back to the hospital one way or the other."
"You think he's got a gun, bro?" T asked.
"Probably," Dupree said.
"You know who's the only crack shot in the family?" T asked me.
"Let me guess," I said. "John Harden."
"He could trim a gnat's pubic hair at 50 feet, said Dallas. "The boy can handle a gun." We passed four landings to small, nondescript houses before we rounded a curve of the river and saw a dock downriver 50 yards. John Harden's boat was pulled up high into a weed-covered backyard. We tied our boats to the dock and, according to the plan we had devised the night before, made our way toward the cinder block house in two groups, keeping well hidden by the deep woods on either side of the house. A plume of black smoke curled above the chimney in the windless morning. The air smelled of mildew and swamp cabbage. Deer tracks pocked the soft ground, scrolling an odd set of hieroglyphics on the forest floor. Dupree remained the single, legitimate outdoorsman among us. He raised bird dogs, kept the engine to his boat in repair, and made sure both his hunting and fishing licenses were current. T and I watched Dupree as he moved with speed and quietness out of his hiding place to the side of the house, where he disappeared from our line of sight. Then we saw him low-crawling on his stomach to the front of the house, where he crouched on a makeshift porch, then peered into the bottom pane of a greasy window. Having trouble seeing, he moved on his hands and knees to the next window, rubbed it with his palm, and looked hard inside. He rubbed the window again and put one eye against the clean spot he made with a saliva-dampened finger. He did not hear the door open or see John Harden until the deer rifle barrel touched his temple. As Dupree raised his hands above his head, John Harden marched him out into the center of the grassless, weedy yard. He forced Dupree to kneel down with his hands behind his neck, as John Harden's eyes scanned the forests for signs of the rest of us.
"Come on out, or I'm going to shoot Dupree's dick off and feed it to the raccoons," John Harden shouted, and his voice echoed off the walls of huge trees.
He'll make us get naked again, tease us about our little dicks, make us swim for the bridge on Highway 17, T whispered, but I motioned for him to keep quiet. Dallas broke first and emerged from the woods on the opposite side of the house, trying to bluff his youngest brother with all the prestige of his profession.
"Just give it up, John Harden," Dallas yelled authoritatively, waving a piece of paper. "This is a warrant for your arrest, little brother. It's been signed by 3 law enforcement officials in Waterford County and your own father. Dad wants you arrested and behind bars. He wants them to lock you up and melt down every key that fits your lock. I'm your only chance, John Harden. With me as your lawyer, I promise I'll get you out on bail quicker than a trout farting in mountain water."
"A trout farting in mountain water?" I whispered. "Where'd he come up with that?"
"When he's scared, no metaphor's safe with Dallas," T explained. "Listen to his voice. He's terrified." "You're wanted by the law in 3 states, John Harden. There's a nationwide search on for you, an all-points bulletin. It's going to take brilliant legal work to keep you from doing hard time. A man who finished in the top 10 in his law school class. A top-notch barrister who can charm a jury, reason with a judge, who can take a case that's an egg and turn it into an omelet."
"Get on your goddamn knees," John Harden said, "before I blow your head clean off your neck."
"I hope your lawyer sucks," Dallas said, sinking to his knees. "I hope your roommate in prison's a huge black gay rapist who's the captain of the prison basketball team."
"That was racist," T whispered.
"It sure was," I agreed.
"I could blow you guys apart right here on your knees," John Harden said, "and never serve a minute's time in prison. You know why? Because I'm crazy. I got the papers to prove it. Both you guys teased me when I was a little kid. Who knows? That might be the whole key to my schizophrenia." "Who knows?" Dupree said. "It might have been Mom's cooking." "Shut up," John Harden screamed. "Don't you say one word against our beautiful mother. Maybe she wasn't perfect, but look who she married, our horrible father, who didn't deserve to even know such a saint, much less to marry her. She had dreams, our mother did, big dreams, and you don't think she was disappointed having 4 asshole sons in a row? I admit I've disappointed Mom, too, but she says that I was too sensitive to survive in this dog-eat-dog world. Her whole life was sacrificed to Dad and you smelly cocksuckers. Mom understands me like no one else."
"Then why are you killing her, John Harden?" Dupree asked matter-of-factly.
"Don't say that again. Don't you dare, horrible Dupree. Horrible, worthless, good-for-nothing Dupree."
"He's right," Dallas said. "Her only chance is the chemotherapy."
"You ought to see what it's doing to her," said John Harden, and there was true horror in his voice. "She can't keep food down at all. Mom won't eat anything because she throws it right up. It's taken everything out of her, killing her from the inside out."
And then T made his move toward the clearing. He entered in mid-scene, talking wildly and with exaggerated hand motions, like a sailor trying to flag down a passing ship. His southern accent deepened and grew shrill during crises, and when John Harden pointed the rifle at him, T began to sound like a mule skinner in a southern stock production.
"Bro, bro, bro, bro,"
T began barking at John Harden, his voice rising in pitch like a lapdog.
"Bro, bro, bro."
"What in the hell do you want, T?" John Harden asked, leveling the rifle at his brother's heart.
"I heard you the first time. How many times do you have to say bro before you think I get it?"
"I was nervous, bro," T said.
"I hate being called bro," John Harden said. "Say it one more time and I put a bullet in your heart. What have you got to be nervous about anyway?"
"My mama's dying. My brother's crazy. I've got someone threatening to shoot my young ass," T wailed. "This ain't like lying in a hammock, bro."
"He said bro again," Dupree said. "Shoot him, John Harden."
"You shut up, Dupree," John Harden warned.
"I've got an appointment back in town," Dupree said, looking at his watch. "I'll lose my job if I don't make it back."
"You? A job?" John Harden laughed. "You work at an insane asylum, locking up innocent crazy people like me."
"I'm meeting a client," Dallas said. "Big money's involved."
"You're nothing but a brown shoe, 2-bit lawyer who wears cheap ties and doesn't even own a fax machine," John Harden said. "Dad may have been a drunk, but he had a great legal mind. He changed the world with his legal opinions, while you fix traffic tickets for Puerto Ricans who get lost on I-95.
"That's a fairly accurate summation of my career," Dallas admitted, and Dupree laughed.
"Always joking. Everything's a big laugh to you guys.
but real humor is lost on you guys. What you love is humiliation, character assassination, ridicule.
T said, That's Dupree in Dallas, bro. My humor's just like yours, John Harden.
Thanks, T, Dallas said. Nothing like a united front to get us all through this.
We've got to take Mom back to the hospital, Dupree said, rising to his feet.
Get back down on your knees, John Harden demanded, striking the back of his brother's knees with the rifle butt.
By this time, I had seen and heard enough, and more out of sheer frustration than a moment of sudden valor. I charged out of the woods, making as much noise as was humanly possible. I did not even cast a glance at John Harden or the others, but ran directly up the unpainted steps of the cabin as John Harden screamed at me from behind. I heard him yelling to halt as I entered the house and found my mother, frail and barely conscious, in a sweat-soaked sleeping bag by a wood-burning stove. I put my hand to her forehead. I don't think I've ever felt a higher fever on a human being. Lucy opened her eyes and tried to say a few words, but she was delirious, lost to the voraciousness of her fever. Lifting her up, I was furious and unstoppable.